This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're listening to Fresh Air. We're experiencing some technical difficulties. We hope to have them straightened out in a moment. Please stand by.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi Kurdish opposition forces have accused the Baghdad government of ordering air attacks on their positions in violation of the ceasefire agreement with the Allies. The Kurds say one helicopter was shot down. With the unrest in Iraq continuing, there have been more reports of the authorities strengthening security in and around Baghdad. Gerald Butt reports from Nicosia.
According to Kurdish opposition groups, Iraqi Air Force bombers and helicopters attacked the city of Kirkuk, situated in one of Iraq's main oil-producing regions. Kirkuk was captured by the rebels a week ago. Kurdish forces say that many people were killed both in this raid and in an earlier one carried out by helicopter gunships further north on the town of Dehuk. The Kurds claim to have shot down one helicopter. Opposition groups have appealed to the United States and other members of the anti-Iraq coalition to take action to prevent Baghdad using air power. The other main development has been the continued strengthening of loyalist positions in and around Baghdad. However, reports of unrest have continued to filter out of the capital, and there were said to have been further clashes between rebels and the army. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
There were massive unemployment protests today in the cities of what used to be communist East Germany. The region's been hit by widespread job losses. Tens of thousands of people marched to protest what they say is the failure of the unified government to do anything about it. An estimated 60,000 people marched in Leipzig demanding the resignation of Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Speaking today in Bonn, Kohl refused to resign or to take more labor-oriented members into his ruling coalition. Kohl's government has been accused of underestimating Eastern Germany's economic problems. Soviet miners are continuing to pressure the government despite warnings that their strike may ruin the Soviet economy. Justin Burke has more from Moscow.
Striking Soviet coal miners defied a call by the prime minister to return to work today, standing firm on demands for better working conditions and President Mikhail Gorbachev's resignation. The government maintains the strike threatens the Soviet economy. Miners say officials aren't serious about negotiations and are trying to organize strike breakers. The strikes at about 150 mines across the country have already idled many factories. Officials add spring planting efforts could be hampered if farm equipment isn't properly supplied. The situation is so bad, Parliament will consider Tuesday ordering a suspension of the strike for 2 months. Parliament has that right if it deems a strike illegal. For National Public Radio, I'm Justin Burke in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the stock market made some slight gains today, despite what traders said was a lack of any significant news to drive prices one way or another. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 2,865.84. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The Soviet cabinet has ordered a ban on rallies in Moscow for the next 3 weeks, apparently to prevent demonstrations in support of Russian leader Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin faces a vote of no confidence during an emergency session of the Russian Republic's parliament. Several groups, led by the anti-communist movement known as Democratic Russia, had planned massive demonstrations in support of Yeltsin. A similar rally earlier this month drew nearly 500,000 people in Moscow. Hardliners in the Russian parliament called for the emergency session after Yeltsin made a nationally televised speech demanding the resignation of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. King Hussein of Jordan is making a visit to Syria. The two nations share a common border, but they were on opposite sides of the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Jackie Lydon has more from Amman.
King Hussein hasn't visited Syrian President Hafez al-Assad since 1988. His trip comes under the title of Arab fence-mending, With Jordan's close ally, Iraq, ever more crippled and isolated, it's time for Jordan to look for some new allies in the Arab world. 2 months ago, Syria began providing Jordan with crude oil for the first time in the kingdom's history. Jordan and Syria have had chilly relations, but also a common enemy, Israel. And today, spokespersons for the king and Hafez al-Assad said an Arab peace conference should take place soon and that the Palestinian question cannot be a separate issue. I'm Jackie Leiden in Amman.
Reports from Albania say that there have been more clashes between authorities and people who are trying to emigrate from the country. Witnesses said that police and soldiers fired on a crowd of people who massed at a dock in the port city of Durrës. News reports said that the people were drawn to the dock by a rumor that American ships were about to land there and take people to the west. 5 people were reported to have been wounded in the shooting. There was no word on the shootings from Albania's government, the last hardline communist regime in Europe. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eric Hansen's new book is set in the Middle East, but it's not about the Gulf War. What brought him to Yemen in 1988 and 89? Well, it's a long story. Here's the short version. 13 years ago, when Hansen was traveling around the world, he was shipwrecked while sailing in the Red Sea. For 2 weeks, he was a castaway on a desert island off the coast of Yemen. He was rescued by smugglers. He buried his possessions for safekeeping, thinking he'd return a few days later to pick them up, but he didn't. The most valuable possession he left behind was the journal of his travels in the 1970s. In 1988, while he was living in New York, he found himself thinking about these journals so often that he decided to go after them. And that's what brought him to Yemen. Eric Hansen's new book, Motoring with Muhammad, is about the search for his journals.
I happened to have 7 years' worth of travel journals with me when I was shipwrecked. And it wasn't until probably 3 or 4 years ago when I started writing professionally that I started daydreaming about what I had left behind on the island. These, they're more than journals. There were short stories. There were interviews with people. And I had written them in sort of very easygoing style. I had no intention of selling any of these stories. But once I did become a professional writer, the value of these lost notebooks gained enormously.
Why was it so hard to get official permission in Yemen to go to the island in which you had buried your journals 10 years before?
Well, the problem with going back to Yemen in 1988 and 1989 to collect the journals was that even though the islands off the coast of Yemen, which are largely uninhabited except for temporary fishermen camps throughout the year, is that the islands guard the major port, Hodeida, from the Red Sea. There's the Russian military equipment is offloaded in the same vicinity. The terminus of the Hunt oil pipeline is within 5 miles of the same area. And it's suspected or rumored that on one or more of these islands, there's a PLO training camp. So the islands that I had visited in 1978, which nobody even thought about, in 10 years later, were sort of, very much affected by politics and, military activity.
One of the things that keeps coming across in your book is the way your sense of time was completely changed living in Yemen. Everything seemed to take a lot longer. People would always say, Inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning what? God willing?
Yeah, Inshallah means God willing. Things will happen when they're supposed to happen. In the United States, I think we're all used to making plans, filling out our week at a glance or day at a glance notebooks, and scheduling our time in advance. In Yemen, as in other parts of the Islamic world, things unfold sort of at a more natural, leisurely rate. There's always time for more discussion, more negotiation, more cups of tea. And I think that it's just a different pace of life. They're not rushing. They're not in a hurry to accomplish, different tasks.
Are there certain sights and smells that you think of as defining your stay in Yemen?
Probably the most distinctive smell is that of ground cumin, coffee, pepper in the marketplaces, the smell of henna, which is a very fine powder, smell of cloves, cardamom, dust in the air, diesel fumes. The thing I like about the Middle East is there are a lot of different smells, and you walk through different parts of the town, and they're just all very evocative of another period in time. I might be walking through the spice market, and then later that day I'll be sitting in a restaurant, and all those spices that I was smelling in sacks are all incorporated with the food. It's a very, the sweet smell of tobacco being smoked. It's, I think, visually and almost every other way, all the senses are affected by being in these countries.
You spend a fair amount of time sitting around with other men smoking or chewing quat. What kind of herb is it, and does it give you a high? What is it like?
Well, there's a common misconception about the use of quat, which is it's a leaf. I think it's distantly related to either the pepper, I think the pepper plant. And it was, it's sort of the main socializing drug of Yemen. It is so mild, it's hard to really describe the effect. It's certainly no stronger than, you know, a few espressos or, you know, a couple of glasses of wine. And in fact, the most valuable quat, which is chewed sort of like chewing tobacco, you put a ball in the side of your mouth and you just keep adding leaves. The most expensive types of quat have the most subtle effects on the chewer, and the idea is not to get completely wasted and out of control. It's sort of to focus your thoughts, to it's to encourage conversation. And almost every single day of the week they have these cot parties where all the men get together, the women have their own parties, and starting about maybe 1 or 2 in the afternoon until sunset, people will sit around floor on mattresses with bolsters and chew cot, and they will discuss politics, religion, family matters, tribal disputes, water and land disputes. And it's sort of like a town meeting where everybody has to come together as equals. And I found these cot parties incredible. There would be music. Sometimes the men would get up and do tribal dances. It seemed to be a very civilized way of spending every afternoon.
How would you participate since you couldn't speak or understand Arabic?
I would be, most of these parties that I would go to, they're always by invitation. And there were a couple of Westerners there that I became quite good friends with. One of them was a language teacher, and he would take me to all these cot parties, and he would translate most of the conversation for me. And also, there would usually be a few students who spoke a little bit of English.
Can you tell us the story of how you finally got your journals, how you were finally allowed to go back to the island that you had been shipwrecked on 10 years before?
In 1989, I went back to Yemen for the second or third time looking for my journals. And I went to this fishing port, Al-Lohaya, and we hired a fishing boat, a single-engine fishing boat, to take us out to Yukban Island, where the journals had been buried, and the island lies about 20 miles off the coast. And we started off in the morning. There were about 5 or 6 of us in the boat, and we got about 6 or 7 miles out to sea, and the engine broke down. Yeah, we started drifting out into the Red Sea. We had no food, no water, no oars, no sails or anything. And so we bobbed around for a few hours and were eventually rescued by a fishing boat that had wandered off course. And I had been escorted by the National Security Police because although I had obtained permission through the Yemen embassy in Washington, D.C. to go back to these islands, nobody could believe that I was actually looking for travel journals. They thought I was looking for buried money or buried weapons, so they watched me very carefully. But later that afternoon, we found another boat, and we went out to the island. And arriving on the island, I was just overwhelmed by this feeling of walking into a daydream. It had been, I think, 11 years since I had left that island with a group of Ethiopian goat smugglers. And, I mean, just the way my heart was pounding, I walked onto the beach, and I just couldn't believe that I had gotten back there. And I spent about 2 hours, I think, hour and a half, 2 hours, digging in the sand. And just before we had to leave before sundown, according to the security police, I did find the journals, and I brought them back to the capital city, and I spent most of the following 10 days just thumbing through a seven-year period of my life that I hadn't forgotten about it, but it just brought back all the details of, you know, wandering around the world. I mean, it was an incredible experience digging them up.
What do they mean to you now? Do they mean everything you wanted them to mean, you expected them to mean?
Well, it's a tie to my past, and I think that people keep journals and diaries to refer back to. And I wonder whether I had had the journals all along, whether they would have meant so much to me, you know, whether I was, you know, working as a writer or not. But I think the fact that they had been lost for so many years, and I thought I would never get them back again, of course, their value increased in my mind. But once I did get them, I read every single page. I indexed them. I, you know, sort of highlighted what I thought would be good short stories, what would be, you know, good characters for fiction. And it really was. It ended up being a treasure chest for me. It's, you know, probably 1,000 pages of journal entries. And I think what the true value of those journals, or the most significant value, was they were written in sort of a very naive fashion. I had no intention of ever using any of this material professionally. And so there's a very nice tone to them. It's very easy to read them. They're entertaining. It's almost as if I'm watching, you know, little video clips of, not my childhood, but when I was a young man, you know, in my mid-20s, up until I was about 30. And
can you just give us a sense of the experiences that are in it, like the travels that you wrote about in there, where you were?
Oh, God, I mean, just all over the world, living living in the Sinai Desert with Bedouins, you know, fishing with them at night, and, oh, man showing me his tattoo, and then pointing out, which was of a constellation that he was born under, and then pointing up into the sky and saying, you know, there, you can see it right there. What are some of the other things? A 900-mile hike I did in the Himalayas in 1976. Traveling through the Golden Triangle, through Laos, Burma, northern Thailand. A lot of the trips I did, this one in the Golden Triangle in particular, I wasn't paying too much attention to exactly where the borders were, and was traveling with people who were involved with smuggling, the opium trade. And visiting Laos in the mid-70s was amazing. Going to Vientiane for the first time.
Do you still travel a lot now?
Well, it's funny. I started writing because I thought that would be a good way that I could keep traveling. But with the publication of my first book, Stranger in the Forest, I realized that I could actually write as well as travel. And since since the mid-80s, I have concentrated almost all of my time on writing. It seems to satisfy all the things that I got out of traveling.
Eric Hansen is the author of Motoring with Muhammad. Coming up, adventures closer to home. This is Fresh Air. Yak, Montana has been described as being like the end of the world, beautiful, but just too hard to get to. It's home to Rick Bass. He settled there 4 years ago after searching for a place where he could write in privacy in the wilderness. Bass is a geologist and writer whose stories have been very well received by critics. His new book, Winter, is a journal of his first winter in northern Montana. There is no electricity in his home, no phone either, so we asked him to drive to the nearest payphone and call us.
I'm up at the payphone in Yak. There's two payphones, and they don't have doors on them. It's snowing this morning and windy, and but they're angled kind of so that snow just gets in one of them. I'm in the leeward booth.
And how far is this phone booth from your home?
It's about 6 miles. About a 15-minute drive when it's, you know, icy or snowy. So it's the hard thing is getting out of the driveway when it's snowing. Once you get out onto the main road, it's no problem.
How many winters have you spent where you are now?
This is our fourth.
What was different this winter? Anything? Is there anything that really didn't go according to plans?
Oh, I don't know about plan. There was a lot more snow this year, which was wonderful. It's such a almost feel like a farmer or a rancher, you know, watching the snow, you feel such a feeling of richness as you see it accumulate. It's like a currency for the coming summer, because the summers have been so hot and terribly dry out here that it's a fire danger and it's a real stress on the rivers and on the animals. And so, I mean, we've got, it's like having money in the bank or something, having this much snow down and this late in the year. It's a great feeling. It should be a good summer with luck. And a lot of luck, we may not have bad fires this year.
This was the winter of the war in the Gulf. Did you feel bad then about being so cut off from information? I mean, you don't have a radio or TV or daily newspapers.
Yeah, I did feel, we felt terribly cut off, and yet, you know, there was such a frustration with, I mean, we recognized from the first day in the papers and stuff that we were being jacked around, saying, oh, we're ready to fight. Now we're not ready to fight. And we figured it was all for our best not to listen to any of it, because it would all sort itself out in the long run, which is to say, you know, history. And it still sorted itself out. So we just took the attitude from the first day that we'd read about it when it was ready. We did put in water in case we got some nuclear stuff going and started, you know, there was some terrorism over by the nuclear plant over in Washington and stuff. But we picked up this Canadian station that drifts in and out sometimes on cold nights. You can pick up a real faint Canadian station, and they were talking about it. So we could hear snatches of news for like 2 and 3 minutes at a time until the wind shifted or something.
What are your reasons for living remote, far away, isolated?
I think it's basic, you know, at the bottom line, it's control. We just have more control over our lives. We can control the pace, and I think it's mostly control.
Are most of the people who live around where you live native to the area?
No, nobody's, except for one guy, Kenny Breitenstein. Oh, there's two couples, also the Canavans, but hardly anyone is native. Everyone's come here from Texas or Oklahoma, it seems.
Oh, really?
There's some people from other places, but I'd say half, maybe two-thirds, are from Texas or Oklahoma.
And do they have similar reasons to the reasons that brought you there?
Yeah, I think so. Nobody really articulates it or talks about why they're there, but they talk about why they're not where they're not, and you can kind of extrapolate from that, just not liking cities and rushes and stuff.
I asked you to bring a copy of your book with you, so let me ask you to get it out and to read an excerpt of Winter for us. And this is, you know, your winter journal.
Sure.
From Montana. And this is a new book that's just come out. Let me ask you to read the entry from October 7th and refresh my memory about what the year is.
This is the summer of 1987, that first winter that we moved up here. Excuse my runny nose.
Yeah, I feel bad we're keeping you out there in the phone booth. You must be freezing.
Well, it's not freezing, but it's windy, and I don't have my gloves on. October 27th. I'm falling away from the human race. I don't mean to sound churlish, but I'm liking it. It frightens me a little to realize how much I do like it. It's as if you'd look down at your hand and seen the beginnings of fur. It's not as bad as you might think. I have a family back in Texas. My whole family, for 5 generations now. Elizabeth's whole family is in Mississippi. I need a dream hoop. The days are great, heavenly. It's only at night sometimes that I feel a little guilty, and the nights are long at this time of year. No one in our families has ever left home, not for good. They're so far away. My family and the other part of my life, friends, acquaintances, they're another galaxy. It makes no sense. It's a strange way to live, but I like it. If happiness were cheap, it wouldn't be worth having, I tell myself, again.
Let me ask you a stupid question. How do you know when you're happy?
Well, I'll give you a stupid answer, a corny answer. I laughed out loud 2 days ago when I was hiking. I was just looking at this view. I hiked about an hour up through that, you know, melting snow. It was crusted and easy to walk on, and I walked real far up this mountain behind our house and got up and turned around and saw this beautiful view of almost the whole valley and just started laughing. So I guess, you know, that's an easy answer. When I laugh out loud, I'm happy. But even, you know, I don't always go around laughing out loud. I'm pretty conscious of it. It's you know, it's a black and white thing. I will realize that, kind of like the words will run through my mind. I'm happy. And all the associated feelings of, you know, warmth and security and peace come with it.
You live with your companion, Elizabeth. Is this kind of... Are you married?
Yeah, we got married a couple weeks ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Because the last time we talked, I thought I remembered you hadn't been married.
That's right.
Oh, how come you got married?
Oh, just... I forgot. I'm supposed to say tax purposes because everybody asked that question. We just did.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So is living together in isolation hard on a relationship?
No, it's... I suppose it is, but it's been real good for ours. You know, and again, I guess it gets into that question of if you're built for rushing around, or if you're built for not rushing around, and we just don't enjoy speed or being in a hurry, and so it's been real good for us, real calming, real peaceful to get. I'm laughing; these chickadees are all sitting on the fence looking at me. I mean, like a whole line of them just watching. They're listening to what I'm saying. No, it's been real good for our relationship.
That's nice. So I should let you get out of this cold phone booth, but tell me first, what are you going to be doing for the rest of the day? You have any other business in town?
Oh, gosh, we're driving to Denver. No, we don't have any other business in town. We're fixing to get on the road and do some more book stuff. And I knew when I planned the schedule that this week, it would be snowing and be going up and down over all those passes in the old truck, but we're driving. But anyway, wish us luck.
Yeah, well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
What do you drive?
Oh, it's this old truck. We're taking the dogs with us, and we've got it packed with everything. Just old truck.
Well, Rick, a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
And take good care.
I will.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Writer Rick Bass speaking to us from a payphone in Yak, Montana. His new book, Winter, is a journal of his first winter in northern Montana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many of the experts who interpreted the Gulf War for us on TV, radio, and in the newspapers were affiliated with think tanks like the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute, the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and the Center for Defense Information. But what exactly are think tanks? We'll ask James Smith, author of the new book, The Idea Brokers. Also, world music critic Milo Miles examines the work of Steve Coe, a British producer, songwriter, and musician who's drawn his inspiration from the music and culture of India. And if Oliver Stone's new movie, The Doors, has renewed your interest in the 60s band, why not check out The Real Thing? Critic Owen Gleiberman reviews a couple of Doors documentaries now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Kurdish rebel leaders say that troops loyal to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein have attacked two cities in northern Iraq. Rebels say they shot down one helicopter in self-defense. Jonathan Charles of the BBC has more.
The first attack happened in the town of Dohuk. Four Iraqi helicopter gunships were involved, according to a spokesman for the Kurdish Democratic Party. He said one was shot down by the rebels as it had flown over the town, and the other three had then fled. The rebels say the more serious raid happened a short while later on the Iraqi oil town of Kirkuk, which has been in rebel hands for almost a week. Two jet fighters, thought to have been Mirages, accompanied by five helicopters, bombed the town, causing many casualties. There are signs that Saddam Hussein is now putting much more effort into trying to stem the success of the Kurdish rebels, moving further troops to a defensive line being formed 100 miles north of Baghdad. Some reports say that civilian trucks have been requisitioned by the army to transport tanks and heavy artillery to the region.
Jonathan Charles of the BBC in Tehran. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether cigarette companies are protected from damage lawsuits because of the warning labels they put on cigarette packages and advertisements. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The High Court agreed to review a case involving a New Jersey woman, a longtime smoker, who died of lung cancer at the age of 58. Her family sued three cigarette manufacturers, and a jury in a landmark verdict awarded $400,000 in damages. A relatively small amount, the jury said, because most of the fault for the disease, 80% of the fault, lay with the woman. An appeals court threw out the damage award altogether and ordered a new trial. Both sides appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The cigarette companies claimed that the federal law requiring warnings on cigarette packages and ads shields them from lawsuits. There are at least 45 lawsuits now pending against cigarette companies, and some 400,000 Americans die each year from diseases linked to smoking. A decision against the cigarette companies could open the floodgates to many more lawsuits. The Supreme Court will not hear the case until next fall, with a decision expected by 1992. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has let stand a government rule that makes commercial pilots retire at the age of 60. A group of pilots had gone to court in an effort to get the rule changed, arguing that pilots in their 60s have gained experience that offsets any drop in physical skills. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 7 points to close at 2,865.84 on volume of some 154 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News. In Washington, the Bush administration has officially protested the Israeli decision to deport four Palestinians accused of taking part in acts of violence against the country. A State Department spokesman says the move cannot possibly contribute to the Middle Eastern peace process and that any charges of wrongdoing should be brought in a court of law. Over 85,000 people took to the streets in eastern Germany today in demonstrations against difficult economic conditions. In a third such protest in a week's time, many demonstrators called for new elections in Germany. Barbara Howard reports from Berlin.
The largest rally was held in Leipzig, where 60,000 people took to the main square, the same square where in 1989 massive demonstrations were held that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Only this time, they were calling for the resignation of German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, chanting, "Kohl must go." Under the old system, East Germans were guaranteed jobs. Now, a third of the workers are out of work, and the unemployment rate is expected to reach 50% this summer. Critics of the Kohl government are calling for new elections and the formation of a coalition of major parties, unions, and employers to conquer the problem. But Chancellor Kohl is rejecting calls for new elections, saying his pro-free market government will succeed in the end. For National Public Radio, I'm Barbara Howard in Berlin.
And in Albania, at least five people were reportedly shot and wounded as hundreds of people gathered at a port city on rumors that U.S. ships were about to dock with food aid. The country's communist officials face their first political challenge from opposition parties in elections March 31st. In recent months, thousands of Albanians have fled the country. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved up against other major currencies. Gold prices were down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. World music commentator Milo Miles says some pop styles can be nostalgic, new wave, reactionary, and avant-garde all at the same time, especially when the music is inspired by India.
Every so often, world pop turns up music that goes beyond novelty into true curiosity. And I think the work of producer, songwriter, and keyboardist Steve Coe qualifies. You'd never think of world pop as a product of new wave rock and roll from the late 70s and early 80s. But that period inspired England's Steve Coe, multi-instrumentalist Martin Smith, and singer-actress Sheila Chandra to band together in 1981 to form the group Monsoon. This was a period in which it seemed just about anything might become the next pop rage. Old-fashioned ska from Jamaica had recently come back. Why not try East Indian rock and roll? Coe was the acknowledged mastermind behind Monsoon, and he drew on equal parts Ravi Shankar, George Harrison, Raga Rock, and the wild eclecticism of Indian film music. Coe, Smith, and Chandra made an inspired blend. Aside from Coe's penchant for truly tacky titles, the name of Monsoon's only album was Third Eye. Like many improbable products from the time, Third Eye rolls with enthusiasm and a kind of blessed light touch. It's not a batch of driving rock and roll tunes with a cheesy Bombay ambience. However, Coe is not much of a lyricist and compulsively slides into romantic banalities and cosmic pleasantries. His words didn't get any better when he accompanied Sheila Chandra out on her solo career. On the other hand, they did continue to turn out smooth, Pacific, but not stupid combinations of textures and drones. Some of them even catchy enough for mainstream radio.
I give you the message, I tell you the score. I take down the answer, who could ask for more? I live for the moment, my window's the door. I ask you for nothing, but all you want is more.
After about 6 years of solo career and a number of albums that have become rather redundant, I would say Chandra's options are fairly played out and her impact has been made. Whether Coe thinks so or not, he has recently broadened his horizons and assembled a collection of Indian pop fusion songs that he calls Compil Asian. I warned you about the tacky titles. The one snag with Compil Asian is that Cole provides almost zero information about the various groups he has selected here. But on the whole, it's the most flowing and varied album he's been associated with since Monsoon's Third Eye. Fundamentally, it shows Indian spice mixes well with all sorts of dishes, even Britain's skeletal dance music, Acid House. A couple of the compilation tracks sound like the curious pop style evolved by Indian teenagers in Britain called Bhangra. It's an ideal soundtrack for dancing and meeting girls on the sly when strict parents might disapprove. And finally, Cole comes up with songs straight from Indian film scores, which proves just how chic and progressive that form can be. All the albums I've talked about here can be a little tough to hunt down, but you should make the effort if you're at all curious about current Indian music, and even if you don't care about classical ragas. After all, there is a higher purpose at work here. In his liner notes to compilation, Steve Cole writes that his aim is unity in diversity, bahina abahina, separate yet one.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Fresh Air. During the Gulf War, TV, radio, and newspapers were filled with analysis from military and Middle East experts affiliated with think tanks. Think tanks started becoming household names. Two of the top network TV guest experts, Judith Kipper and William Quant, were both from the Brookings Institution. Brookings' Joshua Epstein was just about a daily guest on NPR. But you probably also heard researchers with think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and the Center for Defense Information. But what are think tanks? James Smith is the author of a new book about them called The Idea Brokers. He used to work for a think tank himself, the 20th Century Fund.
I happened to be down at Brookings, I guess the first day of the Iraqi invasion, and they set up a mechanism for fielding calls from all over the country. It was astounding to me that it was not just the major networks calling, but small papers in the middle of the country, small radio stations, and people like Tom McNauer, I think, did probably a dozen interviews between 9 and noon the first day of the war, and it kept up for weeks and weeks after the invasion.
Let me ask you the question that I figure a lot of people are wondering, having heard so many of the people from the Brookings Institution. What is it? It's a think tank, but more specifically, what is Brookings?
Well, Brookings is, in fact, the oldest of the Washington-based policy research institutions. It was founded back in 1916 as a little research bureau called the Institute for Government Research, that was designed to help government agencies become more efficient. It helped them with their personnel manuals, with their accounting practices. It was like a consulting firm 75 years ago. But it's evolved into a think tank with approximately $100 million for an endowment, an annual budget of about $18 million a year, and it has close to 50 people doing full-time research on public policy problems.
Do they have any ideological bias?
Well, it's curious. Brookings, over the past 20 years or so, has generally been referred to as the liberal Brookings or the democratic government in exile. In fact, historically, it has evolved from an ardent opponent of the New Deal and of the Fair Deal of Harry Truman into an organization that did indeed have some connections with the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, into a place that I think now is probably regarded as the most middle-of-the-road mainstream of the Washington organizations.
You mentioned the Center for Strategic and International Studies as being another one of the think tanks that was very highly represented during the war. Where are they positioned, and what are they?
Well, they're a place founded in the early 1960s by people who were indeed fairly conservative, and over its 25 or so years, it has tended to be somewhat more conservative than say, the foreign policy analysts at Brookings. But nonetheless, it is now certainly closer to the center than it was in the early 60s.
Let's get a little background. What are think tanks? Where does the name come from?
Well, it's a funny word, isn't it? The first use of think tank, in fact, I found in the Oxford English Dictionary. It was a British slang term for the brain, but it seems to have evolved as a word that would refer to the places where military strategists would retreat or retire to think and plan their strategy. It was a secure room. In fact, it may even in the First World War have literally been a tank where an infantry officer might have been able to get out of the line of fire and consult a map. But the word began to be used in the late 1940s to refer to those military contract research organizations, such as the RAND Corporation, and gradually through the 50s and 60s, instead of being applied simply to military research organizations, it was used to refer to Brookings and the other places that came into prominence really in the 1960s.
How are the think tanks funded?
Well, there are several sources of funds. If we look back historically, the older think tanks were the beneficiaries of grants from large foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Ford Foundation beginning in the 1950s. The large foundations saw the advantage of having bodies of experts independent of the foundations, working perhaps closer to government. That's one source of funding. In the post-war period, post-World War II, government began to fund the research in a number of these places. And a third source of funds has been corporate funding. Increasingly, particularly since the early 1970s, corporations, either through their own corporate foundations or through corporate giving programs, have been willing to fund these places.
What do you think are the think tank's greatest benefits to society?
Well, they are a uniquely American invention, if one looks at the whole sweep of the 20th century, although there are think tanks now all over the world. I understand Edward Shevardnadze is even setting up a think tank. But they have evolved in our society for some reasons that are very peculiar to our own political system. Our parties, for example, are notoriously inept at developing ideas. Our parties are really electoral coalitions to get people into office. And the think tanks have, I think, helped us shape ideas, refine policy agendas, and do things that our political parties have not been able to do. We're also, in this country, a people who are suspicious of government. And we've been relatively slow to bring experts into our governmental bureaucracy. But what they've done, and this is one important long-term effect of think tanks, they've demonstrated that our political leaders and our bureaucrats can benefit from having experts in their employ. And we've seen, I think, as a direct result of think tanks, the creation of such organizations as the Council of Economic Advisers, which was set up in 1946. We saw the creation of the National Security Council roughly at the same time. The whole array of governmental research agencies were brought about in part because think tanks demonstrated the value of expertise.
Are there any anything you're more skeptical about when it comes to think tanks?
I'm quite skeptical, and I think that's one of the lessons of the book. One should be circumspect about the role that experts play in shaping our public debate. I think we should be circumspect about the uses of research in our policy debate. And I think there are many think tanks that are largely inconsequential. They're able to produce op-ed pieces and wonderful press releases, but not doing much in the way of serious research. So there are things that we should be skeptical of in looking at them.
James Smith is the author of The Idea Brokers, Think Tanks and the Rise of the New Policy Elite. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Coalition forces are moving deeper into southern Iraq. We'll have a story on that. There's talk at the Pentagon now of a permanent land base in the Gulf, probably in Bahrain, and we'll have a story on that as well. The free trade proposal that President Bush has made for Mexico is running into some trouble in the United States. We'll have two pieces on that, one from the point of view of businessmen here and the other from President Salinas in Mexico. We'll have a piece from Los Angeles on the police department there and the possibility of meaningful reform in Los Angeles, and more on the Supreme Court decision on divorce.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If Oliver Stone's new movie about the Doors has piqued your interest in the group, you can see more of them on some home videos. Critic Owen Globerman has a review of two, Dance on Fire, and the newly re-released The Doors Live in Europe, 1968.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss. Another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss.
Some of the harsher notices given to Oliver Stone's The Doors have made a point of putting down the group along with the movie. They say The Doors were little more than a mildly talented L.A. rock band who had a charismatic lead singer and managed to put out a few good singles. Like a lot of 60s bashing, this is basically nonsense. You hardly have to think Jim Morrison is God to see that beneath his high school poet mysticism, he was one of the most impassioned rock and roll singers who ever lived. That passion is on ample display in The Doors' concert videos. Dance on Fire is a bit of a hodgepodge, but it's also an essential document of the group's career. It includes some primitive attempts at rock videos, home movie footage of Morrison and the other Doors, and the band's infamous performance of Light My Fire on the Ed Sullivan Show. The highlight of this tape is Morrison's crooning rendition of Touch Me.
I'm gonna love ya till the heaven stops the rain.
What's gripping about actually seeing Morrison is the extraordinary contrast between his image and his sound. Here was this beautiful bad boy sex symbol who strutted around in black leather pants and often looked like he was ready to fellate the microphone. At the same time, he had a shockingly smooth and romantic baritone. He may be the one pop performer in history you can honestly compare to both Frank Sinatra and Axl Rose. The newly re-released Doors video, Live in Europe 1968, makes clear what an extraordinary job of impersonation Val Kilmer did in Oliver Stone's movie. Morrison is blissfully self-absorbed, an ecstatic ringleader high on his own magnetism. Watching his outrageously sexy renditions of Love Me Two Times and Backdoor Man, you realize that for Morrison, breaking on through to the other side was an erotic rather than metaphysical trip. For comic relief, this video offers commentary from Jefferson Airplane founders Paul Kantner and Grace Slick, who toured Europe with the Doors.
And we're walking down the street, both bands. You know, Jim's over there, and some, we weren't all together in a big
swinging club. Swinging on a bottle like a gunfighter, you know.
But
just
the
got
kids
into town.
Would offer us drugs.
Everything.
Everything. All the way down this street, they were offering us drugs of all kinds.
Everything.
And we'd say, thank you very much, put it in your pocket. I'll have maybe a little of that later. Maybe I'll have a little drag off of this and then walk for it. And, but you don't take everything you're given, otherwise you would be dead. Jim, on the other hand,
took everything.
Everything that was given to him on the spot.
Morrison's substance abuse almost certainly helped fuel his cosmic death fixation. Live in Europe includes an interminable rendition of the droney art rock epic When the Music's Over. This is definitely one for the fast forward button. In a way, both of these videos are like the Doors albums, erratic but dotted with sublime moments. I recommend renting them for the high points and for the revelation of seeing Jim Morrison live. It's doubtful any rock star could live up to the myth-making hype of Oliver Stone's movie. But at his best, the Lizard King came pretty close.
Owen Globerman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Hello, I love you. Won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you. Let me jump in your game. I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. She's walking down the street, blind to every eye she meets. Do you think you'll be the guy to make the queen of the angels sigh? Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. You, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the return of Laverne Baker, the rhythm and blues singer who had several hits in the 1950s and early 60s, including Jim Dandy, Bumblebee, and Tweedledee Dee. I'm Terry Gross. Join me and Laverne Baker on the next Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Two advent